चरणी निविशेष सुनिश्चे करणी ओम ज्ञानम चिमनंदस्य गनंदन शुलकाय चक्षुर्मीलितं येनं तस्मै श्री गुरवे नमः पञ्चकल्पतृभ्यश्च कृपसिन्धुभ्यः च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. So I've been talking everywhere I'm going about this issue of faith and knowledge, or religion and science, and the alleged gulf between them. We have an obstacle to overcome when we want to talk to people about Krishna consciousness, because they think we're only offering something as kind of, they think that what really has the prestige for solving our problems in life is knowledge and science. And what we do here in this institution, people think of religion, but doesn't have knowledge, but only this kind of third-rate substitute called faith. Right? They have books of knowledge that tell you real things about the world that enable you to do useful stuff. We have these things called scriptures. And so you have to overcome something. Here's what Prabhupada said. He was invited to speak at MIT in 1968. This is the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And he says to them, "You are all students of technology. This Krishna consciousness movement is also another technology." Notice that, huh? Another technology. "Unfortunately," and then he says, "in the modern state of civilization, there are different departments of knowledge. There's a department of teaching medical science. There's a department of teaching engineering. There's a department of educating. So many other departments of knowledge. Unfortunately, there is no department for distributing knowledge in the science of the soul." So he was suggesting that at MIT they should have a department of the soul. And Prabhupada was quite serious about this. And so I take it seriously, because I think we have to imagine what it would take to have a department of the soul at MIT. That's our challenge. Huh? What change do we have to make in people's mentality or their understanding of the nature of things? Prabhupada says something very interesting here. First of all, technology of the senses. Then next, higher technology is of the mind, which is known as psychology, thinking, feeling, and willing. They are trying to understand how they are working. Above this mind, mental science, there is the science of intelligence. And above the science of intelligence, the background is the soul. Unfortunately, we have got technology for the body senses, we've got technology for science, for psychology, but we have neither any technology for intelligence nor any technology in the science of the soul. The Krishna consciousness movement is the technology of the science of the soul. So notice he says no intelligence, no understanding of really the science of intelligence, and even less of the of the soul. So we have to overcome this thing that somehow or other that the soul, ideas like the soul, ideas like God are no longer in some vague, fuzzy area where nobody knows what they're talking about. So, of course, one first thing is really to understand that as far as this idea of faith, that we have faith, they have knowledge. This faith-knowledge dichotomy is entirely misleading, because all processes of knowledge are characterized by faith. They begin in faith for sure, and faith always remains a large component of it, and rightfully so. Although people do not know how to deal with the faith component of knowledge. Well, I mean, it starts like this. You go to a university and you sit down to learn a science. Somebody you've never seen before in your life stands in front of you and starts telling you things, and you believe everything they say. You open your notebook and you write down. And they're telling you about things that, protons, electrons, neutrons, electron shells, covalent bonds, all these kinds of stuff. And you believe every word of it. So it really begins right away in faith. And in fact, our whole way of finding our way in the world starts in faith. We're all of us infants. We start off as infants. And we learn how to see the world and understand the world from authorities. They say the first guru is the mother. And with our mother's milk, we take in so much about the world and how to make our way in it, and what the categories of understanding things are. And really, we have no choice. We accept it on faith. You notice? I mean, it's really faith. So actually, faith is intrinsic to us right from the very beginning. It's there. So when we look at the world, we're already looking the world through a whole set of categories, a whole set of presuppositions about what's important and what's not important, what's worth paying attention to, what's not worth paying attention to, what will make us happy, what will not make us happy, what we should work for, what we should not work for. All these things have been sort of handed to us, and we accept them like that. It says in the Bhagavad Gita, the 17th chapter, Krishna says, Shradamaya ayam purushaha. The human being is Shradamaya. You know what Shradamaya means? It means made of faith. Or constituted by faith, or composed of faith. And then he talks about faith in the mode of goodness, faith in the mode of passion, and faith in the mode of ignorance. But we are constituted by faith. And so, anywhere we start anything, you learn a science, and you find out it begins in faith. Now, the people who now do science don't like to acknowledge that. And they say, yeah, well, we're teaching you, maybe you accept it as faith, but actually, it's really all based on knowledge, because everything that we tell you, we can verify by experiment. We do experiments. And so we can show you, and these experiments are repeatable. they're public. Anybody else can do them. Sometimes they like to use the word democratic. Science is democratic. So you say, okay, can I do the science? You know, say you're going to be a doubter, and everything they say to you, you're going to question. Can I do the experiment? Yeah, sure. But first of all, you won't be able to do the experiments until you learn the science. I mean, maybe what you're going to do experience about is going to be about atoms and what makes them up. But you won't see atoms. You'll see maybe little spots of light on a cathode ray tube. Maybe you'll see dials move. Maybe you'll see in a cloud chamber little streaks of vapor. You won't know how to understand these things unless you know the whole context of the science. So first you have to learn the science before you can do the experiments. And we don't let anybody near this equipment until at least the third year of graduate school. So it turns out that you can't really verify it until you've accepted it. At least accepted enough to spend, you know, so many years studying it. And it turns out not everybody can do these experiments, but only the adepts. Only the special few who work that way. And you find out on the cutting edge of every science, there's just a handful of people that do the stuff, the cutting edge work, and they communicate each other in very arcane mantras that nobody else can understand. It's completely occult. It's like a lot of mathematics, and if they try to explain it to you in English, it doesn't make any sense at all. Because unless you're initiated, you can't understand it. Anyway, they do the experiments. Maybe, you know, 50 people do the cutting-edge experiments, and maybe another 200 understand them. And everybody else accepts it on faith. So that's the way it really works. So that's not so different from what happens in Krishna consciousness. Because our claim is that this is a science. When Prabhupada said it's a technology, means there's a deliberate process of cultivation. And what does it bring about? Well, when Prabhupada says science, he's thinking of the Sanskrit word vijnana. You know, there's jnana, which means knowledge, and then there's vijnana, which means experienced knowledge, ascertained knowledge, or realized knowledge. One place Prabhupada writes that knowledge means information that's contained in the Vedas, that is to say, jnana. And it is scientific because the practitioner realizes this through his or her own experience. So that is to say, and the word that's used for that experience in the ninth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is pratyaksha. Pratyaksha is usually the word for sense perception. I mean, the word pratyaksha literally means in front of the eyes, pratyaksha. But it doesn't mean these eyes, but that it gives pratyaksha, Prabhupada translates as direct perception of the self by realization. So it means that we have a capacity for direct experience of things like the soul or the super soul. And that can be deliberately cultivated. And we say, yeah, you have to go through the process. You have to make yourself qualified. It's nothing more than you know, having to get, a PhD in physics. You also have to become qualified. And actually, in this science, it's much more democratic. because even if you can't get a PhD in physics, you can actually do very well in Krishna consciousness, because Krishna will give you the brain. I give them the understanding, the intelligence by which they can come to me. So even if we don't have it, he'll give it. So how is this possible? Is there such thing as direct perception? of the soul. So it's not really an article simply of faith, but of ascertained knowledge. Not only the soul, but the super soul. So that requires as a process of cultivation. We have these categories, sambandha, abhideya, and prayojana. You familiar with those? Sambandha gyan, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said Vedanta comprises these three subjects. Sambandha means knowledge of relationships. So, and the definition of this knowledge is to know what is matter, and what is spirit, and what is the source of both of them. These three things. Knowledge of relationships. Who I am, what this world is, and what's the source of both of us. Matter, spirit, and the source of both. That's called sambandha. And that sambandha is like a map, which allows you to take the trip. And how to take the trip is called abhideya. What is the method of getting using this knowledge to get to the result, to take the journey? And then the culmination, the goal where you're headed, is called prayojana. What is the result? So for us, this sambandha, this in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita that's referred to as Sankhya Yoga, and the Abhideya is referred to as Buddhi Yoga, Karma Yoga, and then ultimately Bhakti Yoga, and then the Prayojana. What is the goal? Well, actually, for us, it's Krishna Prema. Freedom from the pangs of material existence and the ultimate establishment of pure love of God. Well, is it worthwhile? Do you want that? Are you really interested in that? Maybe people are not interested at all. They may not be attracted to this. Well, you can take modern science. You can also say that modern science has its sambandha, its abhideya, and its prayojana. It's sambandha. What is there? What constitutes reality? Well, we're talking about. We'll start with what they call the hard sciences, the ones that are really the model for everybody else. Even when the sciences are soft, they try to come to the hard sciences. And what makes a science hard is when it can express all its findings in terms of numbers. See, this is the success that science has in dealing with the world, is when it discovered that when you can express reality in terms of numbers, then you can perform mathematical operations, and you can in that way begin to predict and to control the events of material nature. It's a tool. But what you do though, our experience doesn't come to us. Numbers, quantification is part of our experience. But science decides from the outset that we're going to deal with the material world insofar as we can express it in terms of numbers. Now, of course, this is very useful. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. So many things, you know, this whole computer, you know, it exists because we can express the world in terms of numbers. In fact, this computer, really, since we're using binary number systems, you can talk about this whole computer, both the hardware and software, And you can express the whole thing in a string of ones and zeros. And completely exhaust everything that's happening. You could express the whole thing, nothing is left over. This is what they want to do with all of reality. The faith is that we can completely exhaust the contents of all reality with our ones and zeros. And there'll be nothing left over. So you've actually got a kind of interesting slide or a transition from numbers as a kind of useful tool to numbers as definitive of, as the key to all and everything, reality. Because the other thing that then happens is if you can't express it in terms of numbers, it either doesn't exist or it's not worth talking about. So what goes along with this is what people refer to as objectification. It's the elimination of consciousness, the elimination of subjects. Everything. This is called a mechanistic view of the world. And in this view of the world, there's really no room for anything else except structures of matter. A structure of matter is something that you can express completely in terms of numbers. And if anything that you can't, it's not there. But our experience that we have is really much more than just numbers, just more than quantification. And that gets eliminated. You know, there's it's a kind of impersonalism. I looked up this word objectification in the dictionary, and it gives a quotation to illustrate the word from Barry Lopez. He's an environmentalist writer. The definition of objectify means to present or regard as an object. And they quote Barry Lopez, because we have objectified animals, we are able to treat them impersonally. In other words, what he's saying or implying is that animals are persons. What does it mean to say that they're persons? It means that they're subjects, which means to say that they undergo experiences. That we would say they're conscious. But see, what has no place in this world of structures of matter, by this sambandha of just expressing everything in terms of number, is consciousness. Consciousness becomes the big anomaly. Now, and the people that are really dedicated to this worldview really want to eliminate consciousness from consideration. They would like to do this. A goal of the people who are really into this and artificial intelligence is this notion that if you can make a computer that can act almost like a human being, that you couldn't tell the difference, it is a human being. The so-called Turing test. The computer is now ones and zeros, and you can't tell the difference between that and us. Then we're ones and zeros. Or people who now do brain research with neural imaging and things like that. They think they're going to track down consciousness through certain neural circuits, and you won't have to talk about consciousness. You could just talk about things you can measure. Things you can ultimately express in terms of quantity. It's a problem, because the problem is the view of the world is that there are these structures of matter. Over the course of time, for reasons they don't know, these structures of matter get more complex and complicated. But then, and this is what they call evolution. You have molecular evolution, you know, that somehow or other there'd be some atomic particles, and somehow or other they get into atoms, and the atoms get clumped together somehow or other, and they make molecules, and then the molecules become more complex, and especially you get carbon molecules in there, and then you get, well, the organic, and then suddenly something else happens. You get sufficiently complex structures of matter. They usually have to say that something else comes into being, which is not just another structure of matter, but the experience of structures of matter. Look, if there were no experiences of structures of matter, we could not even talk about them. So somebody has to say somewhere that there are they're not just structures of matter, but the experiences of structures of matter. But you've got a universe that's only made of structures of matter expressed in terms of numbers. They get more complicated. That's all there should be. What is this other thing that pops into existence, which is the experience of structures of matter? How do you put that together? How does that arise out of or causally related to structures of matter? That's a different ontological category. So this is why they have trouble dealing with this. You've got something that's an anomaly, and that is the subject. So anyway, you express things in terms of numbers and mathematics. You use that to run your abideya, your process, is this experimental method and empiricism to gradually understand all of reality by this. That's your process. What is your goal? What is your goal by doing this? The goal is to control material nature, to completely and utterly subject material nature to our mastery. That's what you want to do. Now we've seen some success in this, and also, but it doesn't work out the way you think. As Prabhupada says, the more we try to control material nature, the more we become entangled in her complexities. People have started to notice this fact, that nature is not so amenable to our control, and every time we try to control it, things happen that are beyond our control, like global warming, for example. Well, I read the statistic that they estimated that 40% of all the diseases are called iatrogenetic. Do you know this word, iatrogenetic? Iatros is the Greek word for physician. It means diseases caused by doctors. which is why people are looking for, you know, herbal medicines and things like that. Because they always have to turn around and, yeah, you know, we have to recall this one and we have to recall that one. So far, mastery is eluding us on this. So, but anyway, people have this outlook, you know, that ultimately we will solve the problems of life by gaining complete control over material nature, somehow or other. Let's see if it works. This whole thing. By the way, you notice how much it's characterized by the mode of passion, because this aims at lording it over in control. The result of the mode of passion, according to the Bhagavad Gita, is misery. So actually, it will not work. I can safely predict, and the data is coming in. Otherwise, why is the major health problem facing the world mental illness? People are really depressed. And you know why? Because everything is, in fact, very depressing. It's the only sane... It's the only sane response. In other words, the only sane thing to do is to be insane. That's really how it works. It's so strange how we've gotten ourselves in that position. If you're happy, you have to be crazy. You're not connected with reality. Well, at least what they see is reality. Anyway, this what I've described to you at least is the ideal model, and what it does is really eliminate, makes the idea of being a subject anomalous, and. So, we have to start out by telling people that we're going to talk about something that's not just matter. We're going to talk about something that's what Prabhupada calls antimatter sometimes. And that cannot be expressed in terms of numbers, but is of immense importance. In fact, it's the major important thing, and that is the spirit soul. But people will say, well, we only judge things by experience. So how can we have an experience of such a thing? We only have things that are palpable to our senses. How is the soul palpable to our senses? But this is where, we have to point to this phenomena of consciousness, because the symptom of the presence of the soul is consciousness. So not only do we experience the self in that way, but actually the soul is the condition for our having any experiences whatsoever. So when we say consciousness, we simply mean this capacity to undergo experiences. You know, you take something, you take this little recording device here. You see, it's a little machine, takes up room. Described completely in terms of ones and zeros, you know. And my body is the same kind of object, it's another machine. This is recording sound. My ears are recording sound. But nobody here in this thing is experiencing it. And there's really nobody at home. But here's this machine, but I'm undergoing this experience. I'm hearing. I'm seeing. All the while, I'm registering what's happening. By my consciousness. So this machine is entirely an object. But here I'm not just an object, I'm a subject. I undergo experiences. Another way to say it is I have significance for myself. Whereas this little recording device only has significance for others. So This is the subject. This is the person. And this is what we can at least point to this phenomena of consciousness and say this is a very, very important phenomena. And it cannot be eliminated. I think people sometimes work very hard to do that. And in fact, I think the philosophy that we're all machines is gradually turning people into machines. Right, but their problem is that consciousness as we have it now is described in Sankhya as contaminated consciousness. Therefore, it's not really, our consciousness is not as intense as it should be. It's fitful. We're only partially alive in the material world. I tell you why, because the consciousness shrinks back into itself as soon as we identify ourselves with the material body. Because the soul is Satchitananda. The soul is eternal. But when the consciousness becomes contaminated through false ego, I now experience myself as temporary. Here's an anomalous situation. I am eternal, but now I've identified the self with the material body, and I'm experiencing myself as temporary. But my only reaction I can have to that is try to shut down my awareness, because it is a trauma. We're all, every soul in the material body is always traumatized. And therefore we shut down our consciousness. Our consciousness has to be limited. And so these things, in three areas, were shut down. Because we are undergoing the loss of sat, of eternity, of real being. We're undergoing the loss of chit, of knowledge and awareness, and we're undergoing the loss of ananda. So our experience in the material world is we are traumatized by the loss of real existence, of Satchitananda. And so because of that, we are numb. And people, we don't even live our own lives. That's one good reason not to identify with the material body. Because you can't really come alive as long as we're under this misapprehension that I am this body. So the consciousness, the way the self is present to us is our consciousness, but our consciousness right now is very dim and fitful and not really what it should be. But anyway, we identify the self, and then if we take the sambandha of the Bhagavad Gita, then we have a map also of reality, which tells us that the self and the material body are not connected to each other. That there's two streams of energy. One is Krishna's eightfold separated material energy. There's earth, air, fire, water, ether, manas, buddhi, ahankara. Our gross and subtle bodies. That is Krishna's material energy. And then he has another energy, which are the souls. So the souls do not arise out of the material energy. They're constituted separately, and they're irreducible. They exist sui generis, on their own. And the world arises because these two energies flow together. the material energy and the spiritual energy, there's a confluence. And from that confluence, the world arises. This is in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna describes what there is. So I'm going to tell you everything there is to know. And if you know this, there's nothing further. Right? So one is the material energy, the gross one, solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, and space, which as far as material science deals with it. The other parts of the material energy, this manas, buddhi, and ahankara, they can't get a handle on that. But it's there. So all that constitutes the material energy, and that's the not-self. And then there's the self, which is this other energy. They flow together. Now, here you have two different things, matter and spirit, but both of them come from Krishna. Both of them are his energies. And then he says, and beyond that, beyond me, there's nothing further to be known. So that's it. That's the inventory of reality. There's matter, spirit, and the origin of both. He did it. He outlined everything. That's the simple version that you can elaborate it more fully. But this is the map. Now, you know, this people object to this map because it sounds so, well, old-fashioned, medieval even. It's certainly not as sophisticated like the periodic table of elements. You will not, with earth, water, fire, and air, either ever be able to make a computer. But we don't want to do that with this. This map is for another purpose. I want to go back to this a little later. Because a map is not the territory. So the map lets you negotiate through the territory to where you want to go, but it's different from the territory. Even though the map may be useful, it should not be. It is not. It will not turn green in the summer and so on. It's a different thing. In the 22nd chapter of the 11th canto, the question comes up. I think I have it here. Let's see if I have it. Where did I put it? Let's see. The question comes up by Uddhava. Different philosophers have described things in different ways. So here it is. Got it. Let me just read you this. It's about 7 verses. Uddhava inquired, "My dear Lord, O Master of the Universe, how many different elements of creation have been enumerated by the great sages? I have heard you personally describe a total of 28. You can take the 8, you know, you can expand them. God, the jiva soul, the mahatattva, false ego, the 5 gross elements, the 10 senses of the mind, the 5 subtle objects of perception, and the 3 modes of nature. Some authorities say that there are 26 elements, while others say 25, or else 7, 9, 6, 4, or 11. And either others say there are 17, 16, or 13. What did each of these sages have in mind when he calculated the creative elements in such different ways? Well, Supreme Eternal, kindly explain this to me." So this is an old problem. Different categorical schemes for understanding the world. Lord Krishna replied, "Because all material elements are present everywhere, it is reasonable that different learned brahmanas have analyzed them in different ways. All such philosophers spoke under the shelter of my mystic potency. And thus they could say anything without contradicting the truth. Now he explains what this means. When the philosophers argue, I don't choose to analyze this particular case in the same way that you have. It is simply my own insurmountable energies that are motivating their analytic disagreements. By interaction of my energies, different opinions arise. But for those who have fixed their intelligence on me and controlled the senses, differences of perception disappear. And consequently, the very cause for argument is removed. O best among men, because subtle and gross elements mutually enter into one another, philosophers may calculate the number of basic material elements in different ways according to their personal desires. All subtle material elements are actually present within their gross effects, and similarly all gross elements are present within their subtle causes. Since material creation takes place by progressive manifestation of elements from subtle to gross. Thus we can find all material elements within any single element, either actually or potentially. Therefore, no matter which of these thinkers is speaking, and regardless of whether in their calculations they include material elements within their previous subtle causes, or else within their subsequent manifest productions, I accept their conclusions as authoritative, because a logical explanation can always be given for each of these different theories. In other words, they're all right. So he's saying the nature of reality is such that you can have all kinds of different ways of dividing it up, and they're not exactly wrong. But Krishna himself has given us one particular scheme to use for this particular purpose. The fact that there can be other schemes and conflicting schemes doesn't invalidate this. They're good for their different purposes. So our purpose is to become back to life again, to discover who we really are, to become free from the bondage of material nature. That's what we're interested in, and this is how you do it. So this map tells you how to do it, and there's a process that if we understand that consciousness, we can start with what's available to us. We can locate the self in consciousness. And people have not always done this. There's a famous passage that this father of empiricism, one of them, David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, 18th century Scottish philosopher, denied the existence of a persistent and steady self. And then he has a famous passage in when he says, when I introspect and search for a self, I do not see any single persistent thing. Rather, I see what I perceive are sensations, impressions, ideas, feelings, all these kinds of mental entities. Sometimes they're bundled together, but I do not see anything that I can call a self, he says. This is David Hume, very intelligent philosopher. Well, we have to look, and this is his conclusion, there is no self, or there's just a kind of a bundle. Who's looking? When he's introspecting and trying to find himself, who's looking? How did he miss it? It's weird, isn't it? He missed it. Who's looking? Huh? And so actually that's the process. The seer is the self. And in the material world, the seer is the self and the seen is the not-self. Because the consciousness is there. And so Prabhupada actually, in the Bhagavatam, takes us through a thought experiment. Normally, in material consciousness, we identify ourselves with the material body, so, and our body is equipped with senses, so we first think of the seer or the perceiver as this body, and the boundary between the self and the not-self is here at the skin. We can immediately understand that I'm also conscious of my body's working. I'm conscious of the movement of my arms and legs. I'm conscious of my eyes seeing. I'm conscious of my ears hearing. So actually, I'm aware of my own body. So that means the gross elements, the gross body, is the not-self. If the seer is the self and the seen is the not-self, then the body is the not-self. It's actually part of the whole system of material nature. So we withdraw the boundary back, and well, we tend to identify even more strongly with our subtle body, our mind. But then we also we watch our own mind working, just like David Hume was doing it. We see our own mind. We watch the thinking, the feeling. Sometimes we disassociate them from a distance. We watch what our mental operations are. So the thinking and feeling of our minds. So then we have to conclude that the subtle body is also the not-self, and that the self is the seer. This means that my environment is my body and my mind. Actually, the part of material nature I'm most connected with is my mind. This is my most immediate environment. This is the room I live in, really. I carry around with me everywhere. And this is where the environmentalist movement really needs to begin. Remember, subtle things are more powerful than gross. So if you're having some frustration in cleaning up the environment, is one of the side benefits of understanding the nature of reality. So here we can actually, this way we can discriminate, we can understand the difference between the self and the not self. We can understand I am not the body. Of course, then we have to undergo a process. Understanding that, then we have to understand why have I identified myself with the material body. What is the cause of this? Because even though I may accept theoretically I'm not the body, of course, it's very easy still to believe that and still act on the bodily platform and to still react on the basis of the body. And the reason is, of course, is this default ego is the deepest part of our structure. It's whatever theory we have on the mental platform, we have to use the intelligence in such a way that we can correct our idea of ourself. Anyway, what the Bhagavad Gita recommends is the remedy for this is this Buddha Yoga, which means acting without attachment to the results of the work. Ultimately acting in such a way that we become free from material desires. Because this is the problem, what binds us to the material world, which creates the false ego, is the act of trying to be enjoyers in the world. That's why every, if you really want to clear the consciousness, one ultimately has to come to the sattvic platform. The more we become free from the modes of passion and ignorance, the more we will have the capacity to experience ourselves as spirit souls. And not only experience, these two things go together, the realization of the self and the realization of the super soul. They actually go hand in hand. because they're intimately related to each other. And as if you're guided correctly, as one comes into view, so does the other. So there's self-realization, and also there's God-realization. So there has to be the process. That's why everywhere, in any spiritual tradition where people are actually pursuing spiritual knowledge, is there some kind of systematic effort to control material desires and ultimately to become free from them. I've talked about this before a lot. What is the problem with sense gratification? What's the trouble with sense gratification? It is the acts of sense gratification that cause the false identification of the self with the material body. So that actually the acts of sense gratification are really not the cause of our happiness or of our becoming more alive. They're the cause of identifying ourselves with the material body and losing consciousness, becoming more dead. That's the problem with it. That's why if one really wants to become truly happy and truly fulfilled, one has to turn away from the effort of trying to become happy through satisfying the senses. This is news for the consumer society and for the whole course of a civilization based on material science and the mode of passion. The mode of passion will lead but to misery. So anyway, in this science of the self, one has to make oneself in the proper condition to have spiritual experiences. Right now, we're living in such a way, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy, that there is no soul, there is no happiness other than sense gratification. So you engage in that, and then you will not be able to have any idea about the soul or the idea about God. It will almost make it happen. The self disappears. The actual selves, and people become more and more like zombies in their lives. And although they say they're free, actually they're completely controlled by the modes of material nature. So this is a real science of the self. One accepts this process. There's a very well attested. There's a number of ways of going about it, of the prayojana, of the way of realizing this. But in any case, this is a progressive process of spiritual development by which one becomes more and more. First of all, act in such a way that the modes of passion and the modes of ignorance go down. One comes to the platform of goodness. Then when one becomes to the platform of goodness, one can begin to regain the capacity for spiritual experience. And we know how to develop those spiritual experiences more and more progressively. And so that these things happen. Three things happen simultaneously. Bhakti develops, love of God develops, Pareshana Bhava, direct experience of the Supreme, and Virakti Anyatra, and detachment from everything else. These three things happen simultaneously. This is the experience one has, and therefore, and it's repeatable. Anybody who's willing to spend 7 years with the same kind of intensity you'd have to spend 7 years getting a PhD, you will see. And if something goes wrong, we can also say this has gone wrong. This is what you do to correct it. So this is what Prabhupada meant by saying that this is a technology. And ultimately, one will have to see this understood as something that can be in a university as a process of knowledge. They won't belong, they won't, people are worried about, you know, introducing religion. It's not religion, it's science. It's the science of the self. And in fact, this thing has been researched in so many different religious traditions. This is another thing that has to happen, is the people who are engaged in this spiritual research in different religious traditions have to ultimately put their heads together and understand the variegated geography of the spiritual territory there is exploring. Like we know within the Vedic tradition, there's already different experiences. Some have experienced transcendence as impersonal Brahman. Others have experienced transcendence as Paramatma, others as Bhagavan. All those are admitted. In fact, there's a whole lot of a range of things that are there. Just because they're different doesn't mean it's not part of the area that we're exploring. So already there's been diverse experiences that have been recognized and seen as part of realities and organized in a certain way. We know about karma, jnana, and bhakti as another typology for dealing with different results of spiritual experience. We already have this much to offer from our tradition. So that we really have to, if we want to do what Prabhupada wanted, work toward that people will finally accept that we are interested ultimately in what Prabhupada calls the science of self-realization, and there should be a department in the university where people can be taught this. It doesn't mean that the material science will not. Ultimately, there will be a unified science. Isha Upanishad said you have to know these things side by side. And even Prabhupada said that if people use the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam, even in material science, it will lead to many discoveries. So we can also find out, actually. Actually, if a scientist gets inspired by Paramatma, you don't know what they'll find out. That's ultimately what will happen. So that's the case, anyway. What we are presenting is actually a kind of knowledge, and deserves the name of science as much as anything that's done now in the name of science. That the present science is neglecting a very important part, or crucial, the most important, actually, part of reality, the self, who we actually are, and the condition for there being any kind of science whatsoever. How can they all be like David Hume and not see themselves? It's outrageous. So, any questions? Yeah.
You were speaking about how people... Oh, sorry.
You want to hand a microphone around?
Sorry. You were speaking about...
Our technology fails us.
Hello?
Yeah.
You were talking about the people who, like they become like the zombies because sort of like they don't think about the soul. I forget exactly how you put it. It reminded me of sometimes when I look at people and they look like the zombie state, and I see them and I see people like that, like on the subway and stuff.
Yeah.
And sometimes it seems like they don't, and sometimes I talk to people who are atheistic. And they're like, oh, there's no soul. But sometimes I feel like they don't want to have a soul. They don't want nothing to do with that. And I can't understand why. They don't want God. They don't want a soul.
Yeah.
And I can't understand why. I mean, there anything in Krishna consciousness that says why people would want to destroy the soul, why they don't want to...
Yeah, there's the expression, the killer of the soul, huh?
Yeah, I've heard that expression.
The soul-killing civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a pathology. Pneumopathology. You need the science of spiritual diseases. It is a fact that people become envious of God. Just like when you love God, you love everyone, because God is the all-inclusive being. So when you love Krishna, that love expands to include everyone and everything. What happens when you hate Krishna?
You hate everybody.
And yourself, too, don't you? That hate also expands. Yeah, it's quite terrifying, actually.
Can I ask you another thing that has to do in reference with that?
Yes.
Sorry. I need to ask two questions at a time. Sometimes, like, I feel like I want to love Krishna and everything, but sometimes people, they make me so angry, I feel like I hate them. I don't want to hate them, but they make me so angry. Some of the things I see them do, like... pushing little children around.
What they do is wrong.
I get so angry, and I try not to feel that way, but it's very hard to...
Well, of course, you should try to do what you can to stop those kinds of things from happening. Ultimately, the distress when people are doing wrong things should be overlaid with compassion for the fact of people suffering. You know, when somebody's doing something wrong, you may see the victim. You have compassion for the victim.
Mm.
But you should understand what the person who's doing something wrong, what they're doing to themselves, too. First of all, they're future victims.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're creating their own bad karma.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to ultimately feel for their own suffering.
Sometimes I realize that, but...
Yeah, I know. Well, just a question.
But I still get angry.
Yeah. Devotees ultimately have to become tolerant. So.
I had just one brief comment, because something you said was inspiring, and I just heard it the other night when Dr. Arun Dembski was speaking at NYU. He's a
the intelligent design
intelligent
guy.
Design person, mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was also expressing the same point that you made, that now if we're standing from a theistic viewpoint, or a viewpoint that there is a consciousness and a creator, intelligent creator, that now if we're doing science with that understanding, then we'll see different things.
Yeah, sure.
So all kinds of new...
Things will light up, right.
Uh-huh. All kinds of new insights will be possible.
Because you've eliminated that from the outset. You know, it is not the conclusion of science that there is no God. It's the premise. It's not exactly a methodological premise. Let us act as if there is no God so we can just... It starts with that. I've heard report I read of a cosmology conference in Washington, D.C. This is about 20 years ago. At this cosmology conference, somebody gave a mathematical argument that if at the very beginning of the universe, conditions were completely at random, then given the amount of available time, there's no way any amount of anything like the order we have that could have arisen simply by random processes. There's mathematics, statistics that you can figure this stuff out. It just wouldn't happen. That's a very powerful argument. And so he proposed that at the very beginning, conditions were not exactly at random, but there was, at least in the initial conditions of the universe, some order. There had to be. Well, this became immediately controversial, His position was referred to in this article as the stacked deck theory of creation. And the one that everybody prefers is the shuffled deck theory, the random deck. It's shuffled. You know? There's no order. Went back and forth. And the big objection to the stacked deck theory was, if there's already some order, who stacked the deck? And then the article reported that somebody mentioned the name God. And then it said, but most scientists, I quote exactly, most scientists prefer not to take that cop-out route. You see what I mean? It's not like, what's the reason for dismissing it? It's a cop-out. In other words, the game, the rules of the game is no God. It's like you're seeing some people are playing tennis and you say, hey, look, you know, your ball keeps hitting that net, get rid of the net. Then you can get the ball across the court, you know? Something like that. There's a rule of the game that you just can't do it. It's just not done. So, you know, and so that's methodologically not allowed. But if you start looking for it, then you'll start seeing things. And yeah, the whole things will come lit up.
Okay. I had one question also.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a unified spiritual science, which could take into account different experiences of different traditions. Is there such a thing as the Buddhist experience? Is there an experience of nothingness that they're having?
Yeah.
Is a black hole somewhere?
Yeah, it's called the Viraja River. At least according to Prabhupada. They go up to the Baha Tattva, they take a bath and they come. I don't think there is the Buddhist experience, you know. I think one has to be a little open to see. You know, there's Buddhism and there's Hinduism and there's Christianity, but to me it's much more fruitful to just look at Buddhists and Christians and Hindus rather than, they don't all have the same experience, and right now so many diverse things are going on. I bet you could find Buddhists who are pretty much completely theistic. If you look hard enough. You know, it may privilege the impersonal over the personal, but I bet you the personal has a way of creeping in there. Anyway, I know it does, actually. I know it does. It develops like that. Yeah.
No, he's speaking. Same angle.
The soul is often described as a smaller part of the super soul, by which I mean that it has the same kinds of qualities but to a smaller extent.
Yeah, correct.
Now, we often say that the soul gets confused and starts considering the body as self.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the state of confusion of the soul. So if the soul is getting confused and the God has similar qualities, then is God infinitely confused?
Confusion is described with the idea of being covered. So the tininess of the soul allows it to become covered by this illusory energy, but the super soul, being not infinitesimal but infinite, cannot be covered. It's too big. He doesn't become covered by Maya, but the spirit soul, because of this tiny size, becomes covered by Maya. Now, there's a kind of an analog of that in the sense that quite voluntarily, sometimes Krishna himself causes himself to forget. who he is. That's because he wants to. I don't know how he pulls it off.
Can I get an example?
Sure. We're with Mother Yashoda, in order to enjoy being a baby, he causes Mother Yashoda to forget he's God, and then he forgets himself. How he does that, I don't know. But I assume that nothing is impossible. Anyway, I'm not in a position to figure him out, you know. Yeah, he has his reasons. This is he also has a pastime potency that facilitates these things. Because he wants to enjoy all possible kinds of loving relationships. So being God gets in the way. So he gets it out of the way. He doesn't let it stop him. Being God has its drawbacks too. And he gets around them. Because he's God, he can do it. Okay. Yeah, who's next? Oh, yeah.
Very well. It's not on. Very well. Oh, okay. There's two. So you were talking about how material scientists, they like to reduce everything in a numeric way. For instance, the computer is a binary way of reducing ones and zeros. And I know we can't do that with the soul, as you were saying, but in the Vedas, don't they also describe something similar, a similar reduction of matter the three modes of material nature, how everything can be reduced to various combinations of three modes of material nature.
Yeah, sure.
So that's a similar...
Yeah. Well, material nature is definitely like that. It's acceptable to that kind of thing. But material nature is only one aspect of reality. The mistake people always make is to take one... They get a hold of one aspect of reality. And because they have some success dealing with it, they think it becomes the key to all and everything. And that's the problem.
Who guys, is there some system for passing this thing around?
Where we get this.
Okay.
You started the class saying that we should try to like we're not a religion, we're a science. So, but just by the way the things we do and the traditions we have, we're more like resemble to be kind of like a Hindu branch, you know. So sometimes people have a hard time trying to look past that Hindu tradition. So how do we do to present this is a science that's a neutral sign that's not just Hindu, you know, because I mean, I've traveled everywhere like South America, Europe here, and a lot of people just, you know, they like the soul, they like all this stuff, but they really can't, you know, it's like a big problem. How can they change their normal Western lives to become Hindu, you know, like? Dress the way we do. And
I'm not a Hindu about this way of dress. I don't see very many Hindus that dress like this. the dressing is useful for certain purposes, but it's not the thing. Of course, Prabhupada didn't like to use in most contexts this word Hindu. He said there was no such thing. It's not a Vedic word. My favorite experience with that was this incident that happened in the New York airport. That's where this reporter came up to Prabhupada. He had an interview and a press conference. And then walking down the concourse, and a television reporter and his cameraman came running up. They were late. You could see them coming up the concourse, trotting together with his those days the television cameras were huge, so it was quite a scene. They had this big huge camera on this guy's shoulder bouncing up and down, and all these cables and cords swinging back and forth, and they came trotting up to Prabhupada and stopped right in front of him. And I was about a few paces behind, and by the time I stopped, I was right next to Prabhupada, so I saw this whole thing where... Anyway, this interviewer was like, you know, combing his hair and straightening his tie out and everything, and they were disentangling all the cables and the microphone, and the cameraman was focusing, and this guy sticks this microphone right in Prabhupada's face, and he said he's panting because he was running. He says, "How does your religion differ from other Buddhists?" What would you say, you know? Oh no, we're Hindu. This is what Prabhupada said. We have nothing to do with this Hinduism or Buddhism. We are teaching the truth, and if you are truthful, you will accept it. And the reporter had his mouth open for his next question, and it just stayed open. He was literally dumbstruck. And you see what Prabhupada did is he destroyed the mental platform on which the question was asked. Here was this busy reporter who was just going to try to put Prabhupada in the right pigeonhole, and that would deal with him. And then Prabhupada actually called his whole existence into question. The guy was just shocked. Because all of a sudden here was reality, you know. So we have to learn how to be like that. So Prabhupada, he was wearing the clothes of an Indian sannyasi and everything, but it didn't stop him from getting down to reality.
You mentioned that the map is not the territory, which is I was thinking that even before you said it. It's a great, great phrase.
I stole it from somebody. I forgot
who. and you also touched on, and Radhavalba brought up again, this idea of unified spiritual science. If the map is not the territory, then do you consider Krishna consciousness the map or the unified spiritual science that we're looking for?
In the sense that we've been given a map by Krishna, so I think it's highly authorized. It may be in the course of our spiritual investigation we will discover more and more parts of this map. We can fill in more and more territory under the guidance of Krishna. I think that's possible. But I haven't read everything. I haven't seen everything. But both before and after my experience with Krishna consciousness, I've never seen anything as far as a map of the spiritual territory. It comes close to what Prabhupada has presented to us in Krishna consciousness. As far as basic categories like the karma, jnana, bhakti, as far as Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan, and so on, those different kinds of things, those are pretty good. And in some ways, I have so much confidence in those that when I participated sometimes in interreligious dialogues with Christians and people like that, that I've had some success in presenting this idea of bhakti and how bhakti differs from karma and jnana. See, we have something that the Six Goswamis did for us. In the Vedas, there's a karma kanda strand, there's a jnana strand, there's a bhakti strand, and they tend to be mixed up. And the Six Goswamis dissected them apart and isolated, this is pure bhakti, and it has to be free from karma and jnana, and identified these different spiritual platforms. They're generic spiritual platforms. My own conviction is that any sufficiently old and rich religious tradition will also have these strands in them, because people just discover them. because these people's spiritual experiences are on these different platforms. And that if people find out about these categories, they'll go back and look at their own scripture, their own tradition, and also they'll be able to understand pure bhakti. And they can do it for themselves. They don't have to, you know, become Hindus. They can be Christians or whatever. But if they actually practice pure bhakti in their own context, they'll become more and more like us. That's what I'm convinced of. Because I'll find out that, you know, not necessarily killing animals is good for pure. You know, all these things that you just discover, for whatever reasons, that these things are true. And I'm just convinced that if this, but I'm opening to learning other things. I really am. But I kind of have enough confidence or faith in Krishna consciousness to think that we'll be able to digest it and still be true to what we've been given. Okay? Anyone else? Yeah.
We need to learn more science for explaining Krishna consciousness.
I'm sorry?
We need to learn more science, material science, for explain some about Krishna consciousness.
No, I don't think so. I right now, material science has no way of even approaching Krishna consciousness. I do think that those people who are material scientists will, if they actually practice Krishna consciousness the same way, that we find ways to integrate their science with Krishna consciousness, I think that will happen. But there's no problem being a scientist. You know, that there's a perfectly acceptable thing to do. But and you can use it in Krishna service also. But I don't see how sciences that currently constituted can help us with Krishna consciousness. We'd have to change a lot. Okay. Yeah?
Why don't you say to someone who came up with this sort of sophomoric logic that if you say when you perceive something it becomes that's the not self, what the soul experiences is the not self, then we talk about self realization. When you perceive the soul casting the person, the consciousness, in a position of alienating from the self.
And the way you perceive the self is by the ability to perceive other things. It's light reveals its presence by illuminating other objects, and so this way, the self knowledge, or the reflective knowledge of the self, it is shown by your ability to have experiences. Now, when you know God, this is a more interesting proposition. Is that the not self? Well, yes and no. I mean, of course, in this case, we're just trying to distinguish the soul from matter. But the interesting fact is that God is also the self. He's the self of all selves. So this is why when people actually have some God realization, once they have some God realization, they can never ever think that God might not exist. Just as I cannot doubt my own existence, because then who's doubting? So in the same way, when God is known, you also know God with the same kind of immediate reality of your own self, because he's also the self. and self of all selves. There's some overlap like that. So God is known also in the same way. Because you can, because people sometimes say, if you see God, how do you know it's not an hallucination? Because I can see something here with my materializing being hallucinated. But the experience of God is something like you just like you can't doubt your own existence. So that once God is known, you understand that God exists and without the possibility of not existing. So that's different from the knowledge of material things. Yeah, maybe we have to stop. I guess there's one more, huh?
How do you explain in science the Christian consciousness in people without getting involved in your own personal realization? Because people probably get turned off by personal realization. How do you explain to people, in a nutshell, the science to attract them?
In a nutshell. I was just trying to think of what some of the ways Prabhupada would do it. How do you mean you have to avoid your own personal realizations?
They just don't understand.
The guru is the silent now in the world. It's really a truth.
Do they what?
The gurus in the West world is the science. The science people in the universities,
oh, I see, sure.
Schools, mm-hmm. You know, if you somebody, devotee, beautiful devotee, try to explain the science people, they don't accept because the gurus is the science.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But we have to replace the gurus with other gurus. So that's one thing. But now she has a question. I don't really quite know exactly what you're asking. You know, Prabhupada told us that whenever we give a talk or go anywhere to explain Krishna consciousness to people, that right away we should always inform that they're not the body. We should always tell people you're not the body. So I used to do that all the time, you know. I go on street sankirtan. I tell people they're not the body. They say, man, your philosophy is weird. You're trying to tell me I'm not me. So people do have a trouble understanding. When I first had to go out and every day on Sankirtan, and I didn't know anything about Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada wrote this little pamphlet called On Chanting Hare Krishna. And I pretty much memorized it. I didn't want to speculate. I didn't know anything. And I just repeated what was in there. It wasn't my realization. It was Prabhupada's realization. And I just repeated it. And then gradually I understood what I was saying. You just have to find something like that. And
I show scripture.
Huh?
I show scripture. I can't make any mistakes.
Yeah, that's right. Sure. You do it by scripture. Scripture means the realization of more advanced people. Okay, I think it's gone late now. We're going to do a prasada thing. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all very much for coming to this evening's program. I'd like to express our gratitude for His Blessedness Abu for coming and really giving a very enlightening and empowering class, really leaving us equipped with realizations and impressions on our consciousness that can stay with us and we can chew on and meditate and share with others. So let's express our gratitude in our
regular way went without returning three times. Hari Bol.
Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari
Bol! Thank you very much. So, without any further